Hello and welcome to the HOA Show, where we discuss the news, problems, trends, and critical issues relating to life in a homeowner association. Join us every episode, and together we'll explore how to survive and thrive in the dizzying world of HOAs.
Hello, and welcome to the HOA Show. In this episode, we'll be discussing how and when to open up your HOA amenities in the midst of the pandemic. I'm your host, Ryan Gazelle, and today we're joined by well-known common interest development attorney Sandra Gottlieb, as well as Timothy Klein. Sandra is a managing partner of the law firm Swettelson Gottlieb. Their firm has practiced in law for common interest developments for the past 30 years or so. She served as the president for multiple chapters of CAI and is a consistent speaker for CID organizations and events throughout California. She's also a member of the CAI College of Community Association Lawyers. Tim Klein is the CEO of Klein Agency Insurance Brokers, which he founded in 1998. But like Sandra, he's been specializing in common interest development since the mid-80s. He also holds the prestigious CIRMS designation for insurance professionals specializing in common interest developments. Now, how long have you guys known each other, Tim, Sandra?
Over 30 years, since Tim was 5.
Well, glad to have you both here to weigh in on this very important topic. I must have listened in on at least a dozen webinars and programs discussing this. And with summer here, I get multiple emails and phone calls every day on this subject, as I'm sure both of you do as well. I think all of the various questions we're getting really boil down to a few specific points that we'll get into. Number one, can and should we open our HOA amenities, especially the pool, right now in the summer? Number two, if we do open, how do we do so safely? And number three, what are the insurance considerations if we do open or if we don't open? So let's dive right in with our first question. Sandra, what do you think about opening HOA amenities from a standpoint of can we open and should we open?
So the can we open question is a difficult question. There are 58 counties in California. We represent associations in 40 counties. And the can we open is different in 40 counties. It is really a nightmare. So we have to really look and see what the governor is recommending and requiring, and then what each of the different counties are recommending and requiring. And then our boards of directors really have to balance whether or not it's really worth the risk. I mean, we have from the, we're not touching this. So on Memorial Day weekend, Big Bear Lake said it encourages social distancing and face coverings, but they proclaimed they have no legal responsibility to enforce the state orders. And they gave the contact information for the governor's office and the state health department if you have any questions. And we couldn't get the county for San Bernardino to respond. And for our clients in San Bernardino, we said, this is not a good idea to open right now. And they were like, yeah, well, that ship's already sailed, meaning they've already proceeded to do that. So it really depends. We have to keep a careful eye on the numbers and the exposure to liabilities. But I will say our boards of directors throughout the state are just being beat up by the residents of their communities. They're ours, we're home, why can't we use it? What's it to you? Without really understanding the ramifications, it's a very, very difficult time to be on a board and to make these decisions.
So the city says one thing, and then you have to look and see if the county has a different stance on the issue, and that's the order of hierarchy?
That's the order of hierarchy. So we know that certain things were allowed to be open throughout California, but San Francisco has been on shelter in place for months now, and the mayor there does not seem to be opening it up, and they're really controlling their numbers. So I'm thinking she's not all that inclined to move too quickly. Our association gyms and pools in SF cannot be open because those are the mayor's orders.
So it sounds like the message is, Sandra, just don't get ahead of the local health authorities. Is that your recommendation?
That's my recommendation to our boards, because otherwise they really are in a difficult spot if there is, and I'm sure we'll discuss this in detail, an exposure to liability for the association.
Yeah, we will definitely get into that. That leads us to our next question, though. You know, if an association decides to open up their amenities, the municipalities say, yes, you can, how can they do so safely? Do they need to hire a pool gym monitor? I've seen emails from software companies recently trying to address this issue of allowing easy signups for time slots to use the pool or the gym or the clubhouse. What are your thoughts?
If I can go first, one of the things, and I'd like to talk about liability issues with Tim because he can speak to that so much better than I can. But we are recommending to all of our clients that anybody who utilizes the association amenities can only do so subject to a release and a waiver in favor of the association. For the most part, people are so desperate to get back into those amenities that they're agreeing to it and signing it. You know, we hope that they're enforceable. If God forbid somebody gets sick and dies from it and there's no coverage, or even if there is coverage. But I think that it is important for us to have certain protocols in place. I've seen those emails as well. And depending upon the county, we really have different hurdles that we have to jump over in order just to get open. Everybody is requiring clear signage and social distancing and adherence to CDC or health recommendations. And most are requiring masks to be worn when coming in throughout the communities in the common area. We know the governor in our state has required that anytime that you are in out in public, you're supposed to be wearing the mask. Of course, that excludes when you're going into or a swimming pool. But some of the problems that we have is the sanitation issue and the scheduling of these facilities and whether or not we really have an issue with people cleaning up after themselves and whether or not we can rely on them doing that when it's on the association to make sure that all the touch points are clean.
And my first question when you mentioned about the waivers is, who tracks those waivers? That's obviously more work for the property management. And then who stops those folks that haven't signed a waiver from getting in?
And that's the biggest problem. So we have a community last Saturday where somebody wouldn't sign it and the staff didn't want to get into it with that person and they were there. And this was the worst possible offender. No mask. No social distancing, no waiver. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I mention that this was my board president?
Oh, my gosh.
And so clearly that staff was not going to enforce that. And we don't want them to. We want them to report back to management and the board. Remember, we don't have any enforcement powers to enforce the governmental orders for there to be some sort of disciplinary response from the association. So if we are going to want to force them from a disciplinary standpoint, then what we have to do is have our own rules. And I would suggest doing them on an emergency basis. And the boards have to understand that there has to be a significant fining policy to get people's attention. This is not that you want to go through this. It's that you're trying to control an uptick in a particular association and deal with the members of the community who live there.
And then, I mean, obviously, the question is who monitors the ins and outs of those amenities? Do you recommend having somebody stationed out there? I feel like that opens them up to more liability.
I think that it could open them up to a lot more liability because if you set up the structure and then there's a failure. At some point, that person has to go to the restroom, or that person is on a state-mandated lunch hour. And then if you haven't put something in place for somebody to be monitoring that when they're gone, then you had a policy and procedure, rule and regulation, that all of a sudden you're not enforcing. And I think that probably exposes the association to even greater liability. But if you're going to control who has access, then you have to enforce it, and you will have to have the monitor. The pool monitors are very difficult for smaller associations. And depending upon the county, some counties prefer to do your best job you can. Others are saying, no, you have to keep records for reporting. You have to clean the common illness between a household using the pool or spa facilities. And how can a small association afford that? So in our larger communities, it's easier to do. And the software companies that you're referring to who are setting up these reservation systems, those can be used actually by any size community.
And if it's a volunteer, so for a small association, that's a whole nother kettle of fish.
Exactly. But you have no one to pass the liability on to. Is that what you're referring?
I'm referring to the fact that, you know, if you're a volunteer, you don't have any training to follow, to rely on, as far as how you go about prohibiting people from going in, how you keep track of things. You're just a random person out there, a volunteer. And then if there is an insurance claim, are you covered as a volunteer under the D&O policy, under the general liability policy? All kinds of concerns I have about that.
Right. And so I think one of the things that we're recommending, and certainly this is just added layers for protection, is nobody's just a volunteer offering. They have to at least be part of a committee established by the board of directors. And these people are members of that committee that are tasked with responsibility. But it isn't really just about monitoring how many people are there, depending on the county, whether or not they're limited to 10 people or 50% of occupancy. And, you know, the differentials are so huge throughout the state that it really is important to keep track of it. But let's say we dial in and we're in a particular community. It isn't just, okay, they're there for 15 minutes. We have to get this clean. And the next people, their reservation is an hour and 5 minutes later. So there's 15 minutes to do that. There's other things. Somebody comes in and they're not wearing a mask. And they say, I have a medical condition, I can't wear a mask. Oh, well, there's no exception to that. Well, there isn't an exception to that. If somebody has a medical condition, they're not, or they're disabled, and they're not able to wear a face covering, then they have to be able to come in and use the facility. Or if somebody is hearing impaired, and they need to see my face so they can understand what I'm saying to them, neither one of us are going to be wearing a mask. If we're going to have volunteers for our smaller communities monitoring and controlling our compliance, they're going to have to be educated on those types of things. It's not just cleaning the hotspots.
If there is a violation, Sandra, how is that dealt with? There's too many people in the pool, or someone unauthorized is using the pool. Do they have the local police come by? Or?
So if there are established rules and regulations, or the association is adopting their county rules and regulations, let's say it's at 50%, and full occupancy in the pool is 25 people, and Mr. Smith, who's today's designated observer, comes in to make sure everybody's doing something. There's 100 people there. He said, this party is over, and no one leaves. I would recommend they call the police. I would recommend that they call the local health department, because at that moment in time, what are you going to do? We know that that homeowner was not allowed to do that. Presumably, an association had that homeowner sign a waiver indemnifying the association and requiring their compliance with the governmental orders and the association's rules and regulations. What about all their guests that came in? Every county says no guests. That one is easy. I doubt that there's 100 family members living in any particular home or unit in any community in California. So that one's sort of easy. And I know it's an exaggerated example, but it's an example. And I literally was preparing for another webinar that I'm doing next week, which literally came up in Orange County. And they called the police. Sheriff came and said, what do you want me to do? Like, okay.
Can a parent sign on behalf of a minor that wants to use the pool?
Everybody has to sign their own waivers except for minors. And we're taking the position that the parents can sign for their children. There's all kinds of laws about whether or not that's enforceable. Let's say worst case scenario, I haven't heard of this as an example, so I'm really, this is a hypothetical. Somebody signs for their child and that child gets deathly ill and they're on a ventilator forever. And there are laws in California to protect their ability to protect themselves until the age of majority to be able to bring a lawsuit. Does that waiver by the parent mean that that child, when they reach majority, could not bring an action for their loss or their damage? I think that they still can. But we are hoping that we don't run into that type of situation. From an insurance standpoint, I'll throw that back to you. Is there coverage if a parent signs on behalf of their child?
Well, I think the question is not whether there's coverage for that activity, but whether or not there's protection for the association if they have accepted that that waiver, that signed waiver. And interestingly enough, these carriers all have a different position with regard to these types of viruses, communicable diseases, pathogens, and the like. The exclusions all are varied. My advice, it would be to tender, regardless of whether or not you think there's going to be coverage. There's a lot of burdens in California with regard to adding endorsements that would exclude coverage for these types of activities. And there's a lot of carriers who have, may or may not have met those requirements. If they're going to add an endorsement that excludes the virus, they have to give 60 days notice prior to the renewal of that policy. They just can't slip it in at the last minute. And they have to bring it to the attention of the policyholder.
No, they have to bring it to the attention of the insured. So I did not know that. And that's an incredibly important piece of information here. So if there is no exclusion for viruses, and I haven't seen one yet, but I understand there are some policies where there aren't exclusions. But let's say a policy doesn't have one and the carrier wants to add an exclusion, they have to provide notice that that is their intention. And is that on the existing policy? Can they do that?
California Insurance Code states that they have to give at least 60 days, but not more than 120 days in advance of the end of the policy period, notice of non-renewal or reasons for non-renewal, or if the insurance intends not to renew, or the conditional renewal upon reduction of limits, elimination of coverage, or increase of deductibles. So this insurance code section that requires that this notice go out 60 days, and that they have to highlight the reduction in coverage. So that's the highlighting and the notice requirements are pretty burdensome. And there's certainly a lot of attorneys out there who believe that there's a reason not just to challenge if there's been an exclusion added, but whether or not it's been added properly.
But that's at renewal, not not for the current policy. They can't just suddenly change the existing policy.
You can't
policy.
Do it retroactively.
Right.
Correct.
So if we are in the middle of the policy and there was no exclusion in that policy, it gets to run the course of the policy before they could add that exclusion on the next renewal. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's correct. Now, what's interesting, I think, is that switching just to workers' comp for a second, because I want you to hear about an example of something that's happened here in California. In May of this year, Gavin Newsom, governor of California, signed an executive order related to workers' comp coverage that gave the presumption that anyone working outside of their home at the direction of an employer in California between March 19th and July 5th, who was diagnosed with COVID-19, contracted it at work.
It was just shocking when that came down. It's like, how does that liability transfer to an employer who can't make somebody come to work?
I'm shocked by those type of decisions, but you know, it's California.
Getting back to the volunteer amenity monitor, I've heard it suggested by a couple of board members from different associations that they wanted to pay a unit owner that lives in the association to sit out there and become a volunteer. Tim, what do you think that does to their status under the insurance policies? Do they forfeit their status as a volunteer?
I'm going to defer to Sandra, actually. Does that immediately, Sandra, does compensation immediately state then that they're no longer a volunteer?
That's my interpretation. I believe that once they receive any remuneration, whether it's literally dollars or a waiver of some sum of money that might be due to the association, they are no longer under our statute, both the Corporations Code and the Davis-Sterling Act, in my opinion, a volunteer.
And the reason I ask that, and Tim, I'll point this back to you, is in specific regards to the directors and officers policy that will extend coverage to volunteers if it's a good policy.
Yeah, the challenge we have with the directors and officers liability policy is it always has the bodily injury exclusion. So if the claim against the association or against the volunteer was related to or as a result of or in any way came about from a bodily injury incident, which we would consider, you know, being exposed to COVID-19 to be, it wouldn't be covered under the directors and officers liability policy. We may see directors and officers liability claims, and I think we will see those. Maybe associations have not opened the pool yet, and it's having an impact on the marketability of the homes. That's a claim I think we'll see under the D&O policy, and I don't think that there's any exclusion that would apply to that if it's prior to there being an actual contracting of the disease. Once they've contracted the disease, in my mind, the D&O policy is out. It will no longer play it. So we're really relying on the general liability policy. And Sandra's very, very on target here in that she suggested that the exclusion that gets added to the general liability policy only impacts the association going forward if it's legitimately added. But it wouldn't negate coverage for contraction of the virus if it occurred prior to that policy expiring, the existing policy.
But if we're assuming that a number of the general liability policies out there do have an exclusion for pandemic-related claims, what would we expect to happen going forward? Say there's a claim.
I think what we'd see is a reservation of rights letter basically saying we were going to defend you until we figure out whether or not there's coverage. I'd expect that to be, you know, to be issued immediately. Mm-hmm. And then the carrier will rely on their coverage counsel to determine whether or not they believe that there is.
So, Sandra, let's play this through. Let's say an association doesn't have coverage under their general liability policy for, for COVID-related claims. They get sued. They find there's no coverage. They go to their HOA attorney. What would you expect to happen next?
You know, I'm one of the tender early, tender often. And as far as I'm concerned, until we have an opinion from their coverage counsel, they have a duty to defend under reservation of rights, unless we have these exclusions that we are concerned about. And the association, as we know, we don't have coverage in California, do we, gentlemen, for failure to insure if the board of directors fails to obtain insurance without the exclusion? Is there an insurance protection for them under the D&O policy?
You know, there are some carriers that provide failure to maintain, but it would only protect them for failure to maintain prior to there being an exposure of bodily injury. So once there's a bodily injury exposure, then the D&O policy is excused.
Getting back to the example, so they find out from the insurance carrier, the general liability carrier, that there is no coverage. You get that determination from the carrier, and then you have to defend them as their counsel. Do you think it would be difficult for, I think it would be, but I don't know, for the attorney to prove causation on the part of the association? Wouldn't that be the first hurdle?
It would be the first hurdle for the complainant. I'm assuming that's what you mean. So I think that clearly that's going to be a very large hurdle. And we know that both our federal and our state governments and counties in California have already failed at that. I'm not saying that judgmentally, but they've already failed because the tracing has not worked. I know that when the barbershops and the beauty salons and the nail shops were opening up again, they were keeping their own lists of who's coming in, what time, and phone numbers, so that if they had an event in their business, that they could protect against that by being able to provide the information. That doesn't really translate to our homeowners associations, but that works for us and potentially against us. How it works for us is, how can you prove that you came here and the only place that you were exposed to COVID-19 is when you touched the handrail getting into the pool? If you go back to what Tim said a few moments ago, that from March till, I think he said July 2nd, that the presumption was if you got it and you worked outside of your home and you went to your employer's place of employment, the presumption was you got sick while working for the employer at work. Wouldn't that automatically during that time period exclude an association from liability? I think that it would. And that's really how we've been evaluating it. But just because I think the causation element would be ridiculously hard for a complainant to actually prove, it doesn't mean that I'm advising my clients, because of that, that they shouldn't be taking every one of these steps and precautions necessary to provide as many layers of protection of liability, you know, to hold the association not responsible as opposed to liable, which is why I think the waivers and releases, some people say, ah, they're not worth the paper they're written on. Well, we don't have a lawsuit yet on that, do we? So for right now, I'm going to write it on that paper. I'm going to prepare it for my clients, and they are going to, should the board adopt it, make certain that everybody comes into their gyms or their pools are actually signing them before they do, to give us something to work with on this tracing as a defense to the liability.
My issue is just as interesting, and that is, you know, in a workers' comp circumstance, presumably the employee is on the premises for 8 hours. In these circumstances, how long does someone use a swimming pool? I mean, how much time can you spend in a swimming pool? Certainly not 8 hours, much less than that period of time. And particularly if the association is scheduling, you know, periodically, there's really, the exposure is minimal. But I think you asked an interesting question, Ryan. What happens if the general liability carrier and the D&O carrier both throw up their hands and say no? I think I'd submit a claim under the commercial umbrella policy and to see whether or not you could trigger coverage on that. If you have a commercial umbrella policy, they oftentimes have a drop-down provision if there's a coverage that's being provided by the umbrella that isn't being provided by the underlying. And just because they added a certain endorsement on the underlying doesn't necessarily mean that same coverage would exist on the umbrella. I think it'd be worth a test. And the second thing I think
it'd be worth it.
Is that the loss assessment coverage, the coverage that individual homeowners maintain, is a coverage that has typically bodily injury protection and probably is not as sophisticated in terms of exclusions as the general liability policy being procured by the association. And that is to say that potentially, if we had to raise money to provide a defense against the COVID-19 claim, that individual homeowners could present a special assessment levied by the board to address this claim under their homeowner's policy and find coverage there. The challenge is that most homeowner's policies have a very modest amount of loss assessment coverage. And I would think that one of the first things I'd do if I was on a board is quietly make sure everybody in the association talks to their agent or broker about getting more loss assessment coverage. Relatively inexpensive. I know some carriers will go from $1,000 to $50,000 for about $20 a year. And presumably, these policies are all written on an occurrence basis, and the claim is actually the date that the association decided to levy the special assessment. That is, it's not the date that presumably the incident occurred. It's the date the board decides they don't have the money, they're going to have to special assess. Until that date, there is no special assessment. I mean, morally and ethically, it's a little in the gray area, but there's no question that if you call your local State Farm or Farmers or Allstate agent and say, you know, I really want to get more loss assessment coverage, they're going to do it. They're going to add it on. And then you'd have some limits that are available if the board needed to raise money or had a judgment against them for the, you know, the resulting claim. They could do so by really financing through the loss assessment coverage.
I think that's brilliant, Tim. I think it's absolutely brilliant. I hadn't really looked at this that way. I'm worried about our association clients not having the financial resources to protect themselves if there's a claim, because the defense costs themselves are astronomical. And so even if the complainant cannot get to pass the hurdle of establishing that, yep, it was my touching that rail that did it, we still could have $100,000 in legal fees before we get to trial. And so this is, I hadn't thought of that, the brilliant, brilliant way to look at the loss assessment coverage. And I'm glad that you mentioned it today.
So Sandra, but getting back to in this example, let's say if it goes, I guess we're kind of just waiting for the first case to go to court, right? And once that gets decided, then moving forward, other claims of a similar nature, assuming that the judge says, no, you can't blame the association, would they then have legal standing going forward to dismiss those cases?
They would try, and there's, you know, a number of different legal maneuverings that the boards could engage in, demurring to the complaint, an anti-slap motion, things that would allow the association to get out of that lawsuit if another court follows suit in the first holding.
All right. So everything we've kind of talked about so far in regarding claims and insurance has been if we do open. But Tim, what about if they don't open the amenities? What do you see going forward if there's a claim brought against the association for not opening the amenities?
Yeah, I mean, Sandra could certainly probably have more experience in this area than I have. We just haven't seen the claim activity yet. But what I would imagine someone is going to say, despite this marketplace, which apparently is starting to get a little bit soft in terms of the residential real estate marketplace, I think an owner who bought a unit and was anticipating using the gym and the swimming pool is going to present a claim. If they have health issues and so forth, and the activity that is important for them in order to stay healthy, they may try to present a claim. I think more likely that an owner will say, you know, my unit was worth $400,000 with the pool and the gym, and now it's only worth $350,000. I don't know how they're going to, you know, I guess appraisals would be the process of showing that there's actually been that kind of a loss. But I think it's going to have an impact. It's going to have an impact on the marketability of the homes. There's no question about it. When the potential buyer walks onto the premises and sees, you know, the yellow tape or whatever on the swimming pool showing that there's no access to the pool, I think it would dissuade potential buyers from buying in that product.
So say the board is sued for that. Would you see the D&O carrier providing defense?
Yeah, again, this is interesting because every D&O policy is a little bit different. However, I don't think that there's an exclusion that would apply in that particular case. I mean, I could be wrong. I'd certainly present under the D&O policy. I mean, this is what they call a non-monetary claim, because they're not really directly seeing a financial reward for, you know, like bodily injury property damage claim. But what I think is interesting about it is that they really have to prove the D&O, that the board of directors didn't respond as a reasonable board would to the set of circumstances, and that they're making judgment calls outside the norm. If they're following Sanders' advice and they're following the regulations of their local health authorities, I just don't know how they could challenge that.
Well, we've seen lawsuits for everything under the sun. So just because you're doing everything right doesn't mean you won't be sued.
There's plenty of ways to challenge it. It comes under the heading of just because I said so.
Exactly.
And we have lots of just because I said so types of lawsuits. I think to answer your question, Ryan, we would ask two competing offers. An offer from somebody who was willing to pay $1.2 million for that property on March 1st, 20, and the owners thought, well, that's a little low for the market. I'm just going to hang out. And then they put their property, nothing happens, and they do another offer for their property sometime in July or August 2020, and that offer is $850,000. And we have to look at why is there such a huge differential? And if the answer is because we believe that there are no amenities that are coming with this property. So how many people have actually had an offer, turned it down because they thought it was too low, got caught in the pandemic, and now are selling for or getting offers for a lower price? We have not seen that yet, but I'm hearing it. I haven't seen anybody bring that claim. And I don't know if whether we have, you know, verifiable claims. I can't think of a way that the plaintiff in this matter would be able to establish that loss is based on the loss of amenities. And I don't think it matters to a certain extent. If the county's saying or the state is saying you can't open that, guess what? You can't open it. And if there's a devaluation, too bad, so sad. There's a devaluation. We're all suffering that loss. Part of the problem that we're also happening is that homeowners don't want to pay all of their assessments because they say, well, we don't have the pool and we don't have the gym and we don't have putt-putt and therefore our assessment should be lower because clearly you're spending less money. I know every association that we are working with who are opening their facilities are over budget for the year and they're only in July because the cost of doing all... Just the signage, getting the signage printed and posted for their county requirements and the legal fees with preparing the waiver and providing the guidance to the board, those smaller associations, they're over budget. So my point is homeowners mistakenly believe that there's no cost with maintaining these amenities. And since I only get to use the pool for 50 minutes on the reservation system, as opposed to going back to Tim's example, when he was speaking about employees, all day or 8 hours, I should only have to pay a fraction of those assessments. Well, we have fortunately have cases in California which will assist associations in protecting themselves. I don't think it's a slam dunk. I certainly think, again, homeowners have a very uphill battle in winning an assessment argument. The case in California that stands for the premise that your obligation to pay assessments is absolute. Even if the association owes you money in return, it doesn't matter. You can sue for whatever that loss of value is for those amenities if you think you have a case, but you still have to pay your assessments. And I think we're going to find the same thing holds true to the example of maintaining the equity in properties, whether or not you have access to the amenities. The only differential might be if when we reach the point, hopefully it will happen sometime in 2021 or maybe 2022, where our counties and our states say, all clear, everybody go back to their lives. And an association says, we're still not opening up these amenities. We may then have a situation where somebody could prevail in an action against the association at that time. But just because they may.
But that's in regards to devaluation of property. What about, you know, a very conservative board that, you know, the municipality says, yes, you can open, but they're concerned because cases are through the roof. And they say, no, we're not going to open. And they're sued by an owner saying, you are required to open this. I pay these pay for these amenities. I need to be able to enjoy them. The municipality says I can open.
So how we are answering that question, I believe it's the right answer, and I haven't heard anybody else say something different, but in different words, of course. My argument is there's only one bus driver at a time, and we look at the board as the bus driver. Only one group of people is driving this association's bus at a time. If you don't like my driving record, you don't have to elect me again, or you can remove me and put in another board that's going to have a different position. Let's say the decision that board makes is wrong. They were overcautious. We get all systems are go and they're still not opening. As long as they did everything right, meaning they were meeting the fiduciary duties, they were complying with the business judgment rule, relying on the rights of experts, reasonable inquiry, if they make the wrong decision, nope, we're not going to open, they're still going to have coverage. Does that mean that the complainant won't prevail in that lawsuit? I can't speak to that. I don't know. It hasn't happened yet. We don't have that circumstance. But I do know, unless you and Tim tell me differently, that there will be coverage for that D&O policy if the association is sued for that decision.
Here's the thing that I wanted to put into this discussion, and that is there are carriers out there that have a non-monetary exclusion. That is an exclusion that basically says unless there's money damages, this policy does not respond to a claim against the board of directors. And so you've got the potential on some of these carriers' D&O policies where they could have the board sued and the volunteers who are involved sued. And because there's a non-monetary exclusion, there'd be no coverage. So I'd certainly, as a board of directors, I'd be very, very careful about renewing your directors and officers liability policy. The good news is these D&O policies are on claims-made form, which means that once they become in effect, as long as you don't have any knowledge of an act or omission which might give rise to a claim, once the policy is bound and in effect, it not only covers the current board, but it covers every prior board member who served on the board who may have had some input in that decision. So I'd make sure you talk to your agent or broker about a non-monetary exclusion, make sure there's not one in your D&O policy. And then if there is one, get replaced until you have a policy that will respond before you have knowledge of a claim. And I think that there's another area that we need to talk about, and that is what if in the board discussion they talk about John in Unit 301 who they know is positive? Well, they know he's positive, but they don't really know. And fortunately, he isn't positive. He actually tested negative. Those potential discussions of we have the virus. Does someone have the virus? Yes, I heard he has the virus. It could be liable.
So we are cautioning our boards to be very careful about how they address even these issues in their executive session board meetings. Even if things don't make it into the minutes, I could just see in a deposition, what were you guys saying about John? What were you thinking at that point? And do you think it really was appropriate to involve Mary, who's not on the board, in that conversation? I think the answer is different, Tim. If the conversation was about, do we have a duty to make disclosure? So I think there's an obligation, and I know not all lawyers believe this to be the case. I think there is an obligation to make a disclosure that somebody in the community either has it or has been diagnosed. There is no obligation, and there's prohibitions under both HIPAA laws and obligation under employment laws to, and ADA also actually, because COVID-19 has been deemed a disability, and we must protect people who have disability. And so it is weighing the obligations against the potential risk. When we assist our boards in sending out notifications to the community, and I know I am changing your scenario by saying John now has COVID-19, we say in the letter, you're not getting any more information than this. Do not call us. Don't contact management. This is what we will do to protect you, while protecting this person who lives in the community who's entitled to the protection. What happens, however, when you have a situation, which I did, where someone was walking around with it, used the common areas, failed to disclose, and then publicly said in a lobby, don't come near me, I have it. What's it? COVID-19. What's the obligation then, Tim, to make the disclosure in the community? And what will the exclusions and the lack of protections be for our boards that don't take action under that scenario. Is there an obligation then that steps up the notification issue?
Well, it's interesting. You know, there's no stupidity exclusion on these DNO policies. So even though, you know, the board did something that seems pretty ridiculous, there's nothing that says that they have to make the right judgment. They just have to make the judgment that's in the best interest of the community after reasonable inquiry.
Sandra, are you recommending that your communities put up signage within the association advising, please wear masks, please keep your social distancing?
Yes. So if they're not going to have their own rules and regulations that will enable to them to implement enforcement policies, meaning fines or prohibition of using other amenities that are still open, if you're not doing that, you should inherit what your local county and state requirements are. The problems that we have is that, you know, managers call me and say, Mary Jo is walking out of her unit, she's not wearing her mask, and John King down the hall, who's trying to get to the trash chute in a high rise, is furious. The governor says, you have to wear a mask every time you leave your unit and you're out in the public space. We know that these corridors are public spaces within our communities. What are we supposed to do? And that's when I say to board and management, you can't do anything about that violation unless you have your own rule about that. And many associations don't want to have that rule because they've heard me say before, use it or lose it. If you don't have the ability to enforce that rule, where there's going to be somebody there who can take action, who can document the event to provide the information, so when the association calls that owner to a hearing, they can take the action that follows from the rule and regulation, then don't have it. If you're going to be able to enforce it because you have the resources and the ability, then I'm in favor of having the rule. But the point of that story, Ryan, is have it informationally about the state and the county, and then have it specifically if the board adopts rules and regulations concerning social distancing and masking or face coverings in the community.
I have a question with regard to, you know, when we have volunteers during fire season and so forth, or if there's a community watch, these kind of individuals that are volunteering are typically observing and reporting. They're not doing confrontations. They're just observing and reporting. Is that the kind of activity you're expecting in some of these communities where they're required to actually have a more active role in the maintenance of the commoner amenities?
Observing and reporting is really all we can do, because I'm not sending a board, a homeowner who's not on the board, or a manager over to that person who wants to get into an altercation with somebody who believes face masks are stupid. We're not going to do that, because that could escalate into some sort of physical manifestation or a health exposure to the person who's confronting them, because if that person's not wearing a mask, which is the topic of the confrontation, they could be spewing while they're yelling all of those droplets that we're all so concerned about, which is causing people to wear face masks. Some associations have what I call buck slips. On this time, at this date, you were seen doing such and such, and they have them in a triplicate. The staff member or the volunteer hands it to the person, does not get into it, does not make a demand for the mask, does not make a demand that they're against you because you and six other people are in the spa. And the state is saying, how about one household, folks, one person or one household? A copy goes to the management and a copy goes to the corporate record.
What about cell phone pictures?
So then you have this whole question of whether you have an expectation of privacy when you're living in your home. I say you're going into the common area, you're not in your home, so you should have no expectation of privacy. The same thing about not having an expectation of privacy when you're on your cell phone talking and somebody overhears something that can be used against you, the person who's on the phone, I think it's the same thing about using public spaces. The problem with the pictures is that could lead, if the picture is taken, that could lead to an altercation in that moment. And I am, you know, very concerned about putting an association staff for communities that, you know, have staff members in harm's way because they were trying to document it. Having a protocol, even if you're not going to, you know, have a specific rule and regulation for the observing, is probably the best way. Why would Joe Schmo, the employee, make it up when that homeowner is going to be furious when the board calls them in or sends them a, hey, we're in the middle of a pandemic, you've got to stop doing this kind of letter, as opposed to we're calling you to a hearing for those associations that have their own rules and their own fining policies. I'm very concerned about stepping it up where we would wind up having an altercation. And I have to tell you, I've already had them at some associations. Physical altercations, not just yelling.
You know, you have to admit, though, it's a 100-degree day and you're in the San Fernando Valley and the pool is there. I mean, I think people are going to do what people are going to do. I just think on some of those really hot days, it's going to be really hard to enforce some of the pool rules, even though the county may have, you know, set them out very clearly.
So it sounds like the long and the short of it, to summarize, is follow the municipalities. And if your local municipality is allowing the opening of pools, then maybe you should consider that. But definitely don't, if they prohibit it, open up your pool. Correct, Sandra?
That would be my advice, yes.
Yeah. And from an insurance standpoint, Tim, it seems pretty fuzzy as far as a general liability claim if somebody were to get sick, if they do open the amenities and claim that they got sick from the association. We're not sure if there would be coverage under the general liability policies or not. But if they don't open and they are following the municipality recommendations and doing their best practices, then we would expect under a good broad D&O policy for there to be protection for the board of directors. Is that correct, Tim?
I would agree with you. If it's prior to there actually being a virus contracted, then I think that there would be coverage. There's just a governance issue at that point in time. If someone's challenging...
Just a non-monetary claim. And for those communities that do have employees, it sounds like, assuming our governor continues the current stance, that we would expect for the association to be on the hook if any employee were to contract COVID, regardless of where they got it.
Yeah, I think that at this point in time, and again, anything could happen in terms of another order coming from the governor's office. But in the meantime, if it's an employment-related or alleged to be an employment-related incident, it's going to trigger the workers' compensation coverage. I just can't imagine that it would not. And again, we're not real clear about whether or not the umbrellas may respond, but as Sandra has suggested, tender early, tender often. And I would suggest tender early, tender often, tender everywhere.
And that's kind of been the
right
the position of a lot of the liability carriers we've heard from is they haven't taken a stance yet. We'd encourage you to submit it.
Exactly. I would just add that if you have an employee that advises that they do have COVID-19, that you treat that as a workers' comp claim, providing them with the documentation that as an employer you're required to give them within that 1 day period, and then we can deal with it later, whether or not is it provable that they got sick at work, or and that's where they contracted this disease based on the governor's order, which I don't think it was renewed. I think that is no longer applicable. Is that true, Tim? I think it expired.
I'm just wondering if things continue to go south, whether or not he will reinvoke that. I just don't know.
But it still goes along with Sandra's edict of tender early, tender often.
Absolutely. There's no harm, no foul. I mean, workers' comp is a no-fault type policy anyway. No one's gonna really bat an eye if you submit a workers' comp policy that ends up the workers' comp cover doesn't cover. There's no reason to not try.
Anything else to add, guys?
No, other than I'm so appreciative to be included in such a thoughtful conversation today. And Tim, there's so many great things that you brought to the table for all of us to think about, and I appreciate it so much.
Sandra, how can our listeners reach you if they have further questions?
My email address is slg@sghoalaw.com. And our phone number is 310-207-2207. And that number will ring into all of our offices in the state.
And you guys have a blog on HOA law as well, right?
That's correct. Law for HOAs.
Perfect. HOAs with an S at the end.
Correct.
Well, thank you so much. That's our show for today. Extra special thank you to Sandra and Tim for sharing their time and expertise with us. As we end our episode, we'd like to remind our listeners that if you have any comments, questions, or suggestions for topics that you'd like to learn about, you can email us at feedback@hoashow.org. Join us next time on The HOA Show.
To share or subscribe to The HOA Show, visit us at hoashow.org. There, you'll be able to listen to other episodes, find helpful resources relating to HOAs, provide feedback, submit questions, and check out other great stuff. The HOA Show podcast has been made possible by the contributions of Klein Agency Insurance Brokers, leaders in the community association industry. The views and opinions expressed by the podcast, its presenters and guests, do not constitute legal advice. For more information on how the topics and discussion apply to you, please consult with your own legal counsel.